Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale and today I'm talking to Sarah Welch Larson, who is the author of the book Becoming Alien, The Beginning and End of Evil in Science Fiction's Most Idiosyncratic Film Franchise. It's a fascinating original piece of work and it looks at all the alien films in the original quadrology and then the two follow-up films by Ridley Scott, Prometheus and Alien Covenant, with a new eye which will send you back to the series looking for hidden gems and a new sort of comprehension, new way of looking at it, as you'll hear from our conversation. Please, if you like the episode, remember to review it if you can, if you have a second. Like, subscribe, tweet about it, Facebook, Instagram, whatever you can to spread the word on social medias. Also, would you take some time and maybe go over to Cinema Italia podcast, which is a new sister podcast that I'm running to look at the delights of Italian cinema. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
It's part of the Real Spirituality monograph series, which is put out by Cascade Books. They're an imprint of Whiffenstock. And my editor saw me tweet something really dumb, which I guess is the origin story for a lot of good things. normally I don't do like quote tweet with your preference or your favorite movie or whatever, but somebody was doing some sort of a Twitter chain that was, what's something that you can talk about for 20 minutes without any preparation at all? And I quote tweeted it with a couple of things like, you know, houseplants and then this webcomic that I used to follow. And one of the topics that I included was theology and science fiction. And my editor reached out to me via Twitter DMs and said, I am like the acquiring editor for this monograph imprint. Would you be interested in pitching a book for it? And I'd been thinking about writing a book for a little while. I'd just gotten out of a job that took all of my time and into one that gave me the ability to, you know, sit and think for once. And so I took a couple of months to think about it. I knew that I wanted to write about science fiction and something to do with the problem of evil. And I went back and rewatched a couple of movies just to get a feel for what they were talking about the topic, because I don't want to impose any ideas on the movies that I write about. And the Alien series seemed like a really natural fit. At the time, I think I had seen every single one of them except maybe the back half of Alien Resurrection. And so when I went back and I rewatched Alien Resurrection and realized that it fit kind of the themes that I was considering engaging with, that's when I knew that the book was going to work. So I pitched it. My editor, Elijah Davidson, he's wonderful. He was really excited about it. And then it just kind of went from there. And it was a very swift writing process too, because I knew that if I didn't impose like a very strict deadline on myself, I just wouldn't write it. I need to write under a deadline. So I think it was something like 6 to 8 weeks of research, literally just coming home every night and research for 2-ish hours. And then after that, I think the book was written in about 3 months. I turned in the manuscript 3 months after that. So, breakneck pace, never doing that again, but it all came from, just kind of a spur of the moment tweet, about how I was willing to just talk about religion and sci-fi basically at the drop of a hat. I was probably thinking about Battlestar Galactica at the time, but the Alien series also felt like a good fit.
The, old TV series or the new one?
The reboot. So I actually haven't seen the old TV series, and the reboot, I'm going to date myself, but I was just a little bit young for it when it was on the air, but I remember my parents watching it. And then I went through and watched it one summer and it just completely blew me away. And I'm bad at TV, but it's one of those TV shows that I go back and I revisit every once in a while. So when I found out that my husband hadn't seen it, I was like, you have to watch this, partly to understand how my brain works, and then also partly because it's just really good TV.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a real big fan of the reboot. The old version is kind of a Star Wars ripoff. I think in England because I saw the pilot episode of the Battlestar Galactica, the original one, at the cinema, because in England, whoa, they actually showed it at the cinema because they thought this is good enough for the Brits. The Brits won't they won't know the difference.
Well, that was the era of Doctor Who, right? So kind of.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. Doctor Who goes way back to sort of black and white TVs, like the early 60s, I think.
Yeah, I've seen bits and pieces of the Tom Baker era, but I haven't seen much else since the Christopher Eccleston reboot. And then I sort of dropped off in the last few years, but I do like what I've seen. I had a very big Doctor Who phase in high school.
Yeah, it's majorly popular. Post Eccleston, because Tom Baker was my Doctor Who when I was a kid. I was traveling in Texas and I was in like a supermarket, and I asked one of the clerks where something was, and he heard my accent and he was like, oh, where are you from? England. Oh, I'm a Whovian. Are you a Whovian? And, so, and it was just like in this small, you know, little town in you know, nowhere Texasville, and yeah, he wanted to know all about Doctor Who, so its reach has spread.
Yeah, it has. I suspect it's partly because of the advent of streaming, because I think I got into Doctor Who on BBC America. I babysat a lot and I watched a lot of late night TV after like I put the kids to bed, and so that's how I found the David Tennant Doctor Who, and then I went back and watched the Eccleston era on Netflix DVD. And that would have been right around the same time that the series really started to explode over here. And I think a lot of it was just because we had the access to it.
Wow. Now you are dating yourself with Netflix
just
DVD.
A little bit. I think I got it as a high school graduation present, which was lovely for my film education. Actually, I wasn't very much into movies before I graduated high school. And then after that, I realized, oh, wait, I can just sit down and watch something by myself. And it was just a complete revelation.
Yeah, you don't have to wait for permission or that there are two or three people together who all want to watch the same thing.
Exactly. Yes.
And so where are you? You were saying you were sort of doing other jobs and everything. Are you in academia or you know, because to write a book like this, and it's extremely, you know, it's a very more than competently, that's damning with faint praise. It's a brilliantly written book. So
thank you.
you know, are you coming, are you in academia as your professional life?
I am not. Right. And I also wasn't a film studies person. So in college, my degree is in linguistics. And then I came out to Chicago to get a master's degree in the humanities, but with a focus in linguistics. So syntax and semantics. And then I worked at an advertising agency for a few years because that was the first place that offered me a job after I graduated. And grad school is very expensive. And then after that, I ended up working for, and I still work for, an industrial distribution company. So we're known for having like a very large catalog full of industrial supplies. If your if your production line goes down, then we can send you the part next day. And we were doing that before Amazon. So, but the nice part about that job is there is a very high level of academic rigor in the way that we publish the parts that we sell. And there's also a very good work-life balance. And so I was working from 7 to 4 every single day and didn't have to worry about working overtime like I had been at the ad agency. And all of a sudden I had all of this free time, didn't know what to do with it. And movies just sort of came in and filled all of that negative space. And that's where the love for movies and my writing career started to take off. And then that's how I was able to find the time to just sit down and write. And I also have a very supportive husband who was extremely understanding. And as long as we had a couple of nights a week where it was just him and me and we could go on date nights and things like that, he was totally fine with me sitting down and reading because we're both introverts anyway. So we were going to end up reading side by side no matter what.
So and where does the theology come from then? Because that's that was one of the things that you were talking about in your original tweet.
Yes. Yeah. So I was raised evangelical and I'm not that anymore. I'd identify as kind of an angry Episcopalian more than anything else. But because I was raised in a part of the church that is very focused on close reads and on trying to understand the text and trying to interpret the text, that's something that I've always just naturally gravitated towards. So it's something where it's the framework with which I approach the world. And it's something that I can't fully divorce myself from. And my approach toward the text has shifted as my own theology has shifted. But it's something where if there is a theological read of something, then I'm naturally just going to gravitate towards trying to understand a topic within those terms. So I just saw Oppenheimer this week. It's out this weekend as we're recording this. And one of the things that struck me about the film is the way that sin and the consequences of our actions reverberate backwards and forwards through time. And that's just something that occurred to me as I was watching the movie. It seems to be like a pretty intentional theme that Nolan is setting up, but I automatically gravitated towards the spiritual read of it because that's just what I naturally do at this point.
Yeah, he's I mean, I'm not going to be able to see it because it doesn't come out until August the 20th in Italy, unfortunately. Yeah, I'm seriously looking at flights. I'm seriously thinking, why don't I just fly to London and see the film? But it's but yeah, he is a filmmaker I very much admire, and he does seem to have this very consistent sort of idea of I wouldn't necessarily have phrased it as sin, but of guilt, of a good person doing a bad thing for a good result. And that sort of run. I mean, I think of it as a big fat lie. You know, somebody tells a lie in order. And I guess the text of that is insomnia, where the policeman sort of manipulates evidence to put away the pedophile. And that obviously just is the poisoned tree from which all the fruit is then poisoned in a legal sense, but also in a moral sense.
Yeah. And I think maybe some of the sin read also comes from Twin Peaks, The Return, which I'm going to admit up front, I have not seen, but I have read enough about that. I know that there is a theme in there that has to do with the explosion of the Trinity bomb, the first test of the atom bomb being sort of a catalyst for sin and harm spiraling out into the universe as well. So I think it's something that Nolan's thinking about. I think it's just kind of on the brain for a lot of very creative people at the moment. And it's such a powerful image, that mushroom cloud and then the harm that falls out from it, that I totally understand why people would gravitate towards that as being, you know, an example of maybe not original sin, but certainly a very powerful one that should not have been unleashed in the universe.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've just heard an interview with, I think it's Robert Downey Jr. And it's one of those silly interviews where they're completing sort of search questions, automated search questions. And he explains his fascination as partly being because he grew up in the 80s, which I did as well. And I think Downey Jr. Did as well. And the nuclear bomb was very present as a threat. I mean, more present than climate change is today, which is kind of strange considering how much damage climate change is doing today. Maybe that's where we're going. Maybe that's the direction we're going in. But I remember it being like a clear and present, as a child, thinking it was a clear and present danger that we could, we could all be wiped out at any minute, you know?
That's devastating circumstances to be raised under. So yeah. And both, I think, perpetuated by human beings and sort of triggered by human beings, but in a way where the consequences of that aren't something that you could trace back to one person or one origin point, and yet we're all culpable in it at the same time, you know? Like it's a devastating thing to think about. And there is some form of responsibility, I think, on each of us, but it's also not something that any one of us is capable of fixing in the moment. And that's really where the sin thing tends to resonate with me.
Absolutely. Yes. And okay, well, let's the structure of your book is very much influenced by a theologian that you sort of bring in to use as your sort of frame with which to then, and this is, excuse me if I get the name wrong, is it Catherine Keller?
Yes, Dr. Catherine Keller.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Could you just explain sort of where you come across Catherine Keller and what she provides you with?
So the book that I'm engaging with is called Face of the Deep, A Theology of Becoming. And it's a book that is ostensibly just about challenging the idea that God created the world ex nihilo, so out of nothing. She posits that the first two verses of Genesis talk about the earth being formless and void. And so there was something already there, and then divine spark, divine justice, God, whatever you want to call it, put everything into relationship with each other. So objects, animals, human beings, everything was given its form and then put into relationship. And then from that, it follows that sin would be the denial of those interrelationships with each other. So instead of sin being an act of disobedience, which is pretty common in Christian theology, it's more about denying the createdness of other beings and of other objects and saying, no, you're not enough in and of yourself. I'm going to treat you as a tool or as an object or as something that is not living into the fullness of your created being. And that kind of unlocked the Alien movies for me. And I know that sounds a little bit galaxy brained, but the entire Alien series is concerned with the idea that human beings are trapped in a system that does not value them for who they are. And they're trapped in a system that is functionally going to completely dismember them, turn them into carriers for something else that could possibly turn a profit, and then by doing that also destroy them. So you get that with the alien, with the face hugger monster, which literally covers a person's face, takes away their entire identity, turns them into an incubator, and then as the human gives birth to the alien, they're also destroyed and essentially turned into a corpse. And I think it's tempting to say that the alien is the ultimate expression of evil because it is something that we can't fully understand. It's an eldritch horror from beyond the stars. But I would argue that the real villain of all of the Alien movies is the ravenous capitalism that the company engages in as it tries to harness that alien and turn it into a weapon. So the company both treats the crew as expendable in that first film, and then also wants to take something else and turn it into a profit too. So the alien isn't just a villain here. In some cases, it could also potentially be a victim of that ravenous desire to turn something else into a tool for profit.
That is amazing. That's a really, really cogent, really interesting sort of way of looking at it. It sheds new light on it. How does that then relate to Ripley as a figure who's, you know, how does that relate to, say, feminist readings of Ripley as who, especially in the first film, is kind of the last girl, if you like, but by yes. the end of the series has become a figure almost, you know, well, certainly iconic, almost mythological.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, in the first movie, she's kind of a company woman. She's willing to toe the line. She works by the book. She actually sort of throws the book at both Dallas and at Ash as she's trying to ensure the safety of the crew, because she thinks that the rules that the company has set up for her are there to protect her. And those rules aren't there to protect her. They're to protect the company profits. And as she goes throughout the series, as the movies progress onward, she sort of grows and develops into her own person instead of being a company woman. So the first film is sort of an awakening for her that she's more than just what the company wants her to be and do. She can defy company orders and she can work to preserve life, human life in terms of the crew that she's trying to protect, and then also other animal life. There's Jonesy who's in there as well, and she actually goes back for the cat. And I think a lesser person would have just abandoned the cat and said, maybe that'll be a distraction enough for the alien. And then as the films go on, she starts to react to the evil that she's been presented with in the form of the company and in the form of the alien. And her goal is to preserve life and to protect other people from the harm that that evil is going to inflict on them. So when she gets back to Earth in Aliens, she's interested in who else is going to come in contact with the aliens on LV-426. And the moment that she finds out that there are families there, she's devastated by it. And her actions sort of spiral out throughout the rest of the films, at least the first four anyway, where her goal is not so much to preserve her own life, like it is more in the first film. It's to preserve other people's lives, and it's to protect other people, even the lowest of the low, even the convicts on Furina. She recognizes that they're still human beings, even though the convicts in Alien 3 don't even really see themselves as human much anymore. And I think that's the most radical part about her, is that she is a woman. In a certain sense, being a woman, she's probably used to being reduced to her gender and not to be recognized as a full human being. And you really get that in Alien 3, especially. The first two movies don't really bring her gender into it all that much. And then going on from there, just working to preserve life and to destroy something that would take away that life, whether that's just treating other people as tools or actually destroying them and killing them.
Yeah, that's so fascinating in terms of that, the relationship between how you're looking at this with that theological idea, because ultimately it is about... this is probably my best way of introducing it. When I was a kid, I loved science fiction. I was a huge, huge science fiction fan. I still am today. It hasn't changed that much. But when I was a kid, I was also being brought up in a Catholic household, and pretty strictish Catholic household. I mean, went to church three times a week, that sort of thing.
Gotcha.
I remember there being a real conflict, not necessarily from my parents. My dad wasn't religious at all, by the way, but my mum was. There was a real conflict in me that when I was reading science fiction, I kept thinking, okay, but where's God in this? How is this consistent with, how is the Force consistent with Christianity or Catholicism? not just like, oh, God created everybody, but he created Chewbacca as well. I mean, how does that work? And in a sense that I lost that Catholicism as part of my teenage, as my intellectual development, my teenage life. I don't want to by brevity diminish the importance of any of these things. But just for the sake of brevity, that's what happened. Very recently, it's not that I've found my faith again, because I haven't, but what I have done is I've realized that there are questions that are really interesting and are really religious questions. And they don't necessarily depend upon you believing in a conventional Christianity or even a sort of some sort of spiritual framework or anything like that, but a simple question as in why do we exist, or where does evil come from, or you know, who am I in relationship to other things? Those questions are deeply religious questions, and they're important whether or not you know you have a faith. You know, faith is not an essential component of asking those questions. In fact, it could be argued not having faith makes those questions even more vital to explore and to ponder. So when I was reading your book and I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about that idea that where do you get ethics from and where what is evil, then that idea that it's how you treat people and a system such as the company and the feral capitalism that it represents treats people just like components, as disposable bits, is kind of, that's where the evil is. That's the inherent evil. Whereas in some ways, I'm sorry, this is a really long comment, but
no, you're good.
In some ways, as you said, the xenomorph, the alien itself, is just being a shark. You know, it's just doing its thing. It's got a, you know, complicated life cycle and that sort of stuff, but it's just doing what it does. And it in itself, it's cancer, you know, it's leukemia. It's the part of creation that kills things, and it's amoral, you know, it's just not. Whereas the company is the result of a series of decisions. You know, how does that fit with what that was what I was thinking while I was reading? That was sort of back and forth thing with your book in my head.
Yeah. It's funny. When I was working on the book, I was talking about the first chapter with a group of students, and one of them compared the xenomorph to a tiger. So definitely like that apex predator idea. And I think those questions of faith are something that science fiction is really, truly, deeply interested in. And part of me wonders if that might be part of the reason why sci-fi can sometimes be dismissed. I feel like it does, it is not as dismissed now as it was maybe in the mid-century. But science fiction is very much focused on questions of who we are and where we're going, and how do we get there, and how did we get to this point? And sometimes you can bring in that matter of faith or not. And either way, I completely agree with you. I think it's an important question. And for me, faith is kind of the framework that I use to be able to wrestle with those questions. And crucially, I think if my faith specifically, everything that I believe is the one true answer to everything, then I think that I've ultimately failed, because then I'm claiming that I have all of the answers, and that kind of takes away the subjectivity of everybody else around me too, because I'm denying their ability to think and reason and believe what they want to believe as well. So it's a way of moving through the world, but I think it's something that should never be imposed on any one other person, because that would also be denying those people's subjectivity and their ability to think and reason too, which is part of the reason why Dr. Keller's work resonates with me so strongly at this point.
I was going to say, yeah, because that goes against the idea of continual becoming as well. The minute you say, right, sorted it, all the, you know, everything's done, I've sorted it out, I have all the answers, you stop becoming, because you stop searching, you stop yearning for some more clarity.
Yeah, you go static. And I guess to steal an idea from another, from a mid-century author, to steal from Frank Herbert, you know, that way leads stagnation. And once you stagnate, then there's no room for growth or further discovery. You're just kind of stuck with what you've already got. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to be stuck with the world we currently have. I think that there is a better world that is possible. And for me, that seems like a really good expression of what God is and is capable of doing and being. But again, I don't want to impose that on anybody else, because I also could very much be wrong. And that's where the faith part comes in, I think.
Earlier on when I was talking about the alien, and I did say sort of quite rapidly, oh, it's got a complicated life cycle, but that's something that you actually sort of concentrate on at a certain point and say, this life cycle thing is kind of interesting, right?
Yeah, it is. I love Giger's work. I think he's just such an incredible artist, and I'm so glad that he was willing to share a lot of his nightmares with us. And I've been thinking about the alien partly in terms of, you know, being that shark, being that tiger, being that apex predator, but the alien is also fundamentally designed to be a human being's worst nightmare, again, because it's going to suffocate you. It's going to take away your identity. It's going to turn you into a cradle for its own young. And then that's if you're lucky. And if you're unlucky, it's still going to kill you pretty horribly. And I think I get into that throughout the book, but there's also a thread of the creation of the alien in the later two movies in the series. So the book is designed around each of the movies as they come out in chronological order. So Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, and then Prometheus and Covenant really get into the idea of the horror of creation itself and what human beings are trying to do as they attempt to create other beings and then destroy other people in the process, especially with Michael Fassbender's character of David. And I love that Ridley Scott was willing to go back to that well 40 years after the first movie, because he's not interested in just explaining, oh, this is how the alien got its double jaw or something. Like, he's interested in those deeper philosophical questions of why would someone even think to conceive of a creature like this in the first place? And I think a lot of that kind of goes back to that idea of ravenous capitalism, because the final movie, at least so far in this series, deals with the android David creating the alien as an act or an attempt to create something that is more perfect than his own creators and more perfect than he himself is. And the only way that he knows how to do that is to make something that's going to destroy other beings. So he refers to it as a perfect organism, and he refers to it as that partly as a callback to the original movie, but also partly because I think the only way that he knows how to exist is to destroy and to deny other people. And that's a really sad existence. And I find that to be the deepest horror out of all of the series. And that's also part of the reason why I love Alien Covenant, because it's an interesting riff on Frankenstein's monster and on Paradise Lost and on all of these other deeper questions. But it's also, you know, just like a pulp B movie that happens to have a xenomorph in it. It's one of my favorite movies from that year. And it's something that just kind of grabbed me. And a lot of that has to do with Fassbender's performance. But then a lot of that also has to do with the fact that Ridley Scott says, screw all of you who aren't interested in all of these deep philosophical questions. I'm going to go off and I'm going to make basically a philosophical treatise using the IP that I have available to me, because that's probably the only way I'm going to be able to tell this story anyway.
That's so true. And I love the way that I think you say this in the book as you sort of go through it. So it's sort of like the first film is like your basic sort of.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Of B movie, monster movie sort of setup, and then the second one is your horror film, your war film, and then the third is a prison film. But as you're going along, they're getting increasingly more interested in the theological and in the idea of what it is to create, and the fourth one, which is kind of, for many people, was the, and you actually say as well that it's like the alien movie that doesn't feel like it's in the Alien universe.
Yes.
But it does. Well, you said earlier as well, it sort of clicks with your thesis, you know, very neatly.
Yeah, that surprised me. When I first proposed the book, I genuinely wasn't sure that I was going to be able to write a full chapter about Alien Resurrection. And the more that I sat with that movie and the more that I pondered it, the more I realized, like, actually, this is a really rich theological text, despite its extremely flippant script, which was penned by Joss Whedon. And then the almost madcap approach that Junet takes to directing it, it feels like it's a movie that's at war with itself. I genuinely don't enjoy watching it, but out of all of the Alien movies, I think it's one of the most interesting to think about because it is the one that is wrestling with a lot of those heady questions about what does it mean to exist and what does it mean to try to harness the power of the alien for capitalistic and militaristic ends. And a lot of that comes back to Winona Ryder's character, Call, whom I did not know was an android when I first watched that movie. I also didn't know that Ash was an android when I first watched Alien. I'd known about the chestburster sequence for a really long time. I'd been aware of the film just as part of, you know, cultural osmosis. But every time the androids pop up in this series, they kind of surprise me because I think they're almost the stealth protagonists of the series. Obviously, Ellen Ripley is the real true protagonist, but the way that the films treat androids as being sort of background furniture for the first three films, they're essentially tools that have been created by humanity that look a little bit like us, which is really creepy when you think about it. And then Junet and Whedon really lean into that creepiness and the idea of, well, we've created human beings ourselves, or we've created androids ourselves in our own image. What would they think about all of this? And the fact that 200 years in the future, you get a lot of technological advancements, you get some updates in, you know, aesthetics and fashion and a lot of very like late 90s apparel and, you know, ponytails and leather and big boots and everything. But then you also get this idea that the androids themselves have evolved and have decided to create their own androids also in their own image. And they have rejected everything that capitalism and humanity stand for. That to me sounds very interesting. And it also feels a lot more hopeful than the rest of the Alien movies because it posits that maybe someday we will be able to break this cycle of sin and endangerment and taking other people for granted and at less than face value. And you get some of that in Winona Ryder's performance, which I'm going to admit is not necessarily the strongest of her career. but you do get a lot of that self-loathing that she feels, being knowing that she was brought into existence in a world that does not value her for who she is. And yet she's going to still try to fight to make that world better anyway. And she's kind of the Ripley of her movie, because Ripley also isn't really Ripley. She's died and come back wrong. And the two of them interplaying with each other, especially the conversation that they have in the chapel on the ship in a very quiet moment, where Call crosses herself when she enters the chapel. And Ripley asks, did you have that programmed into you too? And Call doesn't answer that question, but I think the movie says, yes, she has, specifically because of what we were talking about a little bit earlier. Like, we have all of these big questions about who we are and why we exist in this universe. And I think anybody who is created and has that self-consciousness is going to wonder that at one point or another. And for Call, there seems to be something valuable in that religious framework that she's going to use in order to shape the way that she does her work.
That's fascinating. And I mean, it's interesting as well to look at that, the series, the way you do as in that span. And it emerges to me, it appears to me as if what we're actually looking at is not a quadrology and then two films. It would be the looking at the history of how those films got made. That would be the temptation. But actually, you're looking at two trilogies. You're looking at a trilogy which is very much based in a variety of sort of cinematic genres. And then you've got the next trilogy. Just the fact that each has a colon suffix, Alien Resurrection, Prometheus doesn't really work, but Alien Covenant.
You could say it's Alien Prometheus, yeah, potentially.
Yeah, potentially. But you've got that idea of mainlining, mythology, and the subtext becoming text, or at least becoming text after the colon.
I love that read. I hadn't actually thought about them as being two cohesive trilogies pushed together. But you're absolutely right. And I do think that Resurrection is the movie on which the entire series turns, because we finally do get that point of view from an android. And then Prometheus and Alien Covenant really lean into that perspective, so much so that the humans almost feel ancillary to the rest of the entire story. And I think that that's totally fine. We've had our story and we've had a really good protagonist in the form of Ripley. Maybe it's time to focus on the consequences of our actions a little bit more rather than just rehashing the same story over and over and over again. And I know one of the critiques of Alien Covenant is that you kind of get a character in Daniels who feels as though she's supposed to be Ripley. And I don't think that that's really necessarily true. Like, she is a final girl protagonist, but she's not dealing with the same questions that Ripley is, because she doesn't have to deal with the same disillusionment of a break from the company that sustained her. She's really more dealing with grief. And that's something that a lot of horror movies lately have been doing. So I don't want to get too much into the, it's actually about grief read, because that's something that I think you can slap on a lot of horror movies these days. But I do think that it's interesting that her brain is completely elsewhere in Alien Covenant, and the movie kind of treats that as just, here's a decent framing device for this, but what we're really going to talk about is the plight of the androids and what happens when you really start to lean into the place that has been carved out for you that you don't necessarily fit in the form of David and also in the form of Walter. I love that double performance by Fassbender, by the way. It's one of my favorite things about that movie.
Yeah, and it definitely nails its colors to the mast in terms of this is the central thing that we're actually really interested in here is the conversation between these two guys who are not guys, that idea as well of I just wanted to pick up on that what you were saying about the use of grief at the moment in cinema is one of the most wildly irritating. It reminded me of, like, in the 80s every cop was divorced, because basically the subtext was he's not gay, but he's, sexually available. He's, sexually active, but he doesn't have a partner, but he's not gay. He's heterosexual, definitely. And it was just such a, it was just such a shorthand for saying that. And now with grief, it just seems to say, oh, these are deep characters. So, Wes Anderson in Asteroid City, and I think in kind of all of his movies, uses grief. Someone has died. One of the characters has lost a wife or lost somebody. And it's used instead of character, And it's just like, you're not really exploring it. You're just occasionally having someone say, oh, things have got harder since my wife died, And it's like, I don't know. I find that I think, is there a term for it? Fridging or something, maybe? Or maybe that's
fridging,
something else.
Yeah, that comes from comic books. But yeah, it has to do with specifically a female death in a character's backstory in order to give them some sort of motivation. It's funny, because I loved Asteroid City, but I think the read I took from it wasn't so much the grief as it was the who are we and what are we doing in the universe part. And the layering of those questions and the use of art both within the movie and then also as a metatextual part of the movie to say, like, we don't really know what we're doing. We're just sort of fumbling around here. And I think it's Adrian Brody who delivers the line about, like, you don't have to understand it. You just have to go out and perform it. Really resonated with me because I also don't understand what I'm doing. And I feel that plight, but the way that Anderson expresses that within such, I don't know, regimented isn't the right word, rigid isn't really the right word, but so precise bounds, that movie worked for me. And normally Anderson doesn't always work for me. There's some of his movies that I love very much and a few that I feel very ambivalent towards. But for whatever reason, Asteroid City grabbed me. And I think it was because there's that subtext of grief in there, but I think it's so much more about the looking outwards after grief and trying to say, like, well, now what? And I don't know that he comes to a good answer. And I like that he isn't telling us how to feel or how to think after a fundamental change like that.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy all Wes Anderson films, but I think his great films always have to have this element of anti Wes Anderson. You have to drop, you know, in the spirit of Prometheus, you have to drop a little bit of that black goo into the mix to just sort of mess things up. I wanted to ask you as well, like, because I don't think we've mentioned this earlier, but when you actually came across the Alien franchise, what was your sort of personal journey? Because obviously you've experienced these before you had any notion of writing the book.
Long before.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
I think the first one I saw was actually Aliens, and I'm pretty sure it was when it was just on repeat on TNT. So it would have been like playing in the afternoon, and I'm pretty sure the first alien scene that I ever saw was the boardroom where Ripley is challenging the board members as they're having that hearing about, you destroyed all of our fancy equipment. And she says, no, there were actual people who died in this disaster too. And then my family had a movie night while I was out babysitting, and I came back and discovered that they had seen Alien without me. So at 10 p.m., I knew they were going to return the DVD to the library. So I decided, screw it, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to watch Alien at 10 p.m. at night alone at 16 in my parents' giant house, which was the ideal way to see it, I think, without having seen it opening weekend in 1979. Terrified me. I was flipping lights on across the house as I was going to bed at 1 a.m. because I didn't know what to do with myself. And I had known about the chest burster sequence just through cultural osmosis. It was something that I was aware of, but I didn't know about Ash. And at the time, I was a huge Lord of the Rings fan. So kind of ruined Bilbo Baggins for me a little bit. Ian Holm's doing such a great, very different performance in that role. And the movie sort of grabbed me, and then I just sort of let it lay dormant. And I watched it alone a couple of other times after that. Watched Aliens, didn't really watch Alien 3 or Alien Resurrection until I must have been on study abroad. And I think it was a very lonely night, and a friend had given me all four movies. And I was just sitting alone in my dorm room watching the Alien movies back to back to back. And I hit a moment in Alien Resurrection where there was a particularly gross death. It's the moment where someone gets the back of his head bitten out, and then he reaches around and grabs a chunk of his own brain and looks at it. And I kept expecting the movie to cut away, and it didn't cut away, and it didn't cut away, and it didn't cut away. And then the moment I saw that piece of brain, I was like, nope, absolutely not. I'm shutting this off. And then I didn't think about the Alien movies for a couple of years after that. I wasn't a horror movie person growing up. I wasn't even much of a movie person growing up. I'd just been curious, and I felt like my curiosity had been sated. And then, flash forward a couple of years, I meet my now husband, and we're both in the city of Chicago, but we're living on opposite ends of the city. So we have to find ways to meet each other sort of in the middle, because otherwise it would be an hour and a half on public transit to see each other. So the Music Box Theater here in Chicago, which is a wonderful movie palace, they still have the pipe organ and everything.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're great. I love them. I sing their praises every chance I get. I'm actually going to see Oppenheimer there again in 70mm this weekend. But the Music Box was doing an Alien Day double feature, Alien and Aliens back to back, Aliens in 70mm. And my boyfriend at the time, now husband, had never seen Aliens before. So I suggested we go and we see that, because it was kind of a good litmus test for our relationship. If he was going to be down with science fiction, then I knew that it would probably work out. And they cranked the sound on that movie because it was in 70 mil. The sound was super crisp. It looked really good. And he was super into it. So I was like, okay, maybe this relationship will eventually go somewhere. And it did. We're married. We've been married for 5 years now. And that sort of reignited my interest in the series. And I went back and I rewatched most of them. And then they've just sort of been living in my bloodstream ever since. And now that I've written a book about them, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to forget about them. And at this point, I love every single one of those movies. Some of them I prefer to think about more than I prefer to watch them. Like, I don't really feel a desire to go and revisit Alien Resurrection unless I'm watching it with somebody else who's interested and has never seen it before. But I'll rewatch Alien Covenant any day, and I'll rewatch Aliens any day. I don't know. I love the themes that they're playing with. And I also love that they're just really good, scary movies, especially the earlier ones. And they don't aspire to be anything more than that. And I think that's their real strength, is that they're so good at what they're doing on the surface that all of the subtext just kind of floats to the top and is crystal clear.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, because I think that's what someone like Giga manages to do as well, because he's just basically doing production design. He's just, you know, he's doing the alien design. He's just designing the costume and the look of the spaceships and the this and the that. And yet by doing that job so well, it just raises everything to another level. And all those questions come out that if you'd had another designer, you just might not have, even bothered with. One thing that, two things actually from your description of Alien earlier in our conversation. One thing I remember watching that, and we used to play a video game on our, you know, old PCs when I was a kid, which was Alien, and it was had great music and stuff. And it wouldn't let you self-destruct the ship without the cat. And it always used to frustrate me. It was like, why do you need the cat? You know, I mean, in the film, I get it, because it's, you know, it's Ripley and she loves the cat, I guess. So, okay. But, you know, that shouldn't stop me from. And so we'd have all these theories about, oh, because the computer won't let you self-destruct if it detects a life form. That's all. Or some. We had some sort of rationale for that, I remember. And the other thing that I only just thought of while reading your book is, why does this huge ship have a self-destruct anyway? I mean, what? Yeah. What purpose does it's real life analog would be like a huge tanker, you know, in the ocean, and you don't have like a few buttons to sort of you turn this three times and press the button and then the ship blows up. I mean, what circumstances would you have? What, like space pirates or something?
Oh man, maybe it's like scuttling the ship.
Yeah,
which I know there isn't just a single button
in order to be able to
do that. But yeah, I suspect that they're kind of taking the seafaring analog in there, and they're just throwing in a convenient, well, it's not a very convenient button, but they're throwing in that ability to scuttle the ship and to raise the stakes. And I love that button is so inconvenient, because it's clearly designed to keep the safety of the ship in mind over the safety of its crew members. There are all of the safeties that Ripley has to go through. She has to push several buttons and turn several levers, all in a specific order, in a way that deliberately slows her down. And I can see that the thought process of the company behind that. They're thinking about safety measures. They're thinking about, we don't want just anybody to go in here and flip a switch and then the entire ship explodes. We want to make sure that this is something that somebody actually wants to do. But that system is also very deliberately designed to make it so difficult to scuttle the ship that in an actual emergency, it's almost completely useless. And then disarming it is also completely useless. And that feels like the company, probably unconsciously, but still very deliberately, protecting their profits over the lives of the people on board the ship.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in that way, we sort of circle back to the notion of evil, which we began with. I mentioned earlier, and you referred to it, idea that the alien is a you know, like a predator, or like you know, I mean, I think Slavoj Žižek has this idea of the big fear, you know, and he relates it to God as well, in the sense that, you know, the shark in Jaws, similarly, you know, if you put all your fears in one place, it liberates you from all the daily fears, the little phobias and the little problems. You know, you know, Chief Brody is no longer scared of water because he's killed the shark. You know, what else is in the water except the shark, you know?
Yeah. He's managed to, exorcise it almost. The shark's almost demonic in that movie too.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And there was someone on Twitter earlier on. I've just rewatched it with my daughter, and somebody said, what does this shark symbolize? And it was like, well, that's a bit of a reductive way of looking at it. I mean, I think it does symbolize stuff, but I don't think it's any one thing. You know, I think there's several angles you can look at it from.
I completely agree. And I think that's why I shied away from just treating just the alien as a treatment of evil, because that feels necessarily pretty reductive. And I think the strength of this series is that you can take everything that you have in yourself to these movies when you watch them. And then you can take away whatever interpretation you want from the series. So because I'm so focused on that theological bent, naturally I'm going to be thinking about the problem of evil, but there's also questions of feminism, abortion, what it is to be, you know, existing in a corporate workspace. You could take this as kind of a Marxist parable almost. And I think all of those readings are good. It's just that question of evil is something that provided a good focus point for me to consider all of them. But the Alien series, I think, kind of adapts to the viewer in a way, kind of like the Xenomorph does. Like, it'll take the shape of whatever host it has. And that also works with those textual interpretations of the films, too. And I do think that that's the case for basically just about every movie that anybody watches. You're going to come to it with baggage, and then you're going to come away with an interpretation that's partly based on that baggage. It's just that it's so much at the forefront that really works for the Alien series. But I'm really glad that the Alien isn't just a metaphor for what it is to be a woman in traditionally male spaces. I think that the moment that the metaphor becomes the entire point, then you've kind of lost the power of the art in the telling, because then it's just a vehicle for preaching a sermon. And I'm definitely not interested in any of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that it does sort of morph into, you know, that's why it's so good at hiding in the ships, because it kind of ends up looking like the ships that it's hiding in, you know, right at the very end. It looks like, yeah, I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's kind of one of its superpowers, if you like, that it's reflecting what is around it.
Yes.
But I mean, that notion of evil as well would kind of presume that the alien could be good at some point, you know, that it could choose to do something good, you know. So in that sense, you know, to you know, paraphrase Nietzsche, it's kind of beyond good and evil, because it doesn't have that. No, it's not operating on that level.
It's that nothingness from beyond the stars. Yeah, I know there are quite a lot of reads of the Alien series in terms of Kristeva's The Abject, where it's something where you can kind of push all of those fears onto the alien, and then you can treat that as something that invades people's borders and boundaries and the borders that they've set up for themselves within their lives. You know, it's neither male nor female. It's something that's going to literally invade your space and invade your body. But that's also, I don't know, I feel like objection is something that's a little bit different for every single person. And it's also that societal construct of, there are certain things that we do not do. There are certain lines that we do not cross. And the fact that the company is essentially designed to create those borders and boundaries for people so that they'll follow the system, they'll do what they need to do in order to be good workers, and then also to turn that profit. And then by extension, Ripley then also becomes abject, because she's going to cross over that border and she's going to defy the system and the boundaries that the company has set up for her. And she's going to say, what you've done in setting yourself up purely for profit is also evil and wrong. And by doing that, she kind of opens up the possibility of another better way where human beings can just exist without also being profit machines.
Do you regret the I think the likely fact that Scott isn't going to return to the Alien franchise? Because I mean, I think he had a concluding film he wanted to do, but you know, I'm not sure he's going to manage. Do you like Alien Covenant to the point that you think, no, actually that works for me as a conclusion?
Oh man, part of the reason why it works for me is because Scott was actually able to do what he wanted to do with the original film. So the script was written before they started shooting, but they kept kicking around different ways to change the movie and change the ending. And famously, Yaphet Kotto was like, I'm not going to get killed by this alien. I'm going to kill it. But one of the ideas that they kicked around when they were nearing the end of production was, what if the alien does get Ripley in the shuttle? And Sigourney Weaver was on board with this. Scott was on board with this. I think the producers nipped that idea in the bud, but the original ending was going to be the alien kills Ripley and then it makes the final transmission using her voice. And so the end of Covenant, when I saw that coming, when those final, I don't know, 60 seconds or so happen, when David impersonates Walter, takes over the ship and disappears for parts unknown with extremely bad intentions in mind, I immediately thought Ridley Scott got to do what he always wanted to do with this series. And he also approached it in such a sideways way that both stories can stand alone. So the end of Alien Covenant is an extremely bleak one. And part of me is curious about what happens afterwards, because I think Scott's done a good job of not just drawing a straight line between each of his versions of this story. But I'm also really, like, I'm curious to know where he would have gone, but I'm also really happy with where the series ended up, because it's just such a bleak tone and ending, and it truly worked for me. I went back and I saw that movie in the theaters another two times after seeing it, because I loved that ending so much. It's such a despairing tone, and you don't really get that in that way very often. So I really value it, because it felt like Scott was finally getting to win out with his artistic vision.
Wow. I'm going to rewatch that. I've got it on DVD, on Blu-ray downstairs, and I've seen it a few times, but that this conversation makes me want to go back and see it again.
Oh, I'm so glad. Good.
and that idea of the original ending to Alien is such a 1970s ending, isn't it? It's like
every
conspiracy theory, the 3 days of the Condor, every film, even The Graduate sort of has that sort of last minute. You think it's a happy ending? No, it isn't. You know?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't think of Alien as being a paranoid thriller, but it is definitely of its time there for sure.
Yeah. The conversation would slot in well with on a double bill. There are so many films that you could put together. As paranoid conspiracy, that's absolutely it. You're right, absolutely. Sarah, absolutely brilliant talking to you. I've got one last question before we close today, which is there a book, a film book, that you could recommend for our listeners?
Yeah, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I have two. I couldn't decide between them. The first one is A.O. Scott's Better Living Through Criticism, which was what turned me onto criticism in the first place. I actually had the chance to go and listen to him talk at a book signing when he was first promoting it. And then the second one is Andrei Tarkovsky's Sculpting in Time. And the version that I have was translated by Kitty Hunter Blair. And it's just such a beautifully poetic book about what does it mean to make a movie, but also what does it mean to make art? And I appreciate Tarkovsky's just unrelenting, uncompromising approach towards making his own work. Stalker is one of my all-time favorite movies. And
oh, me too.
Oh, I adore it. That was a movie that bent my brain when I first watched it, and I'm so glad that I did. And I kind of think of my critical life as being before Stalker and after Stalker. And then reading Sculpting in Time was something that I think illuminated a few things, even though it didn't necessarily explain all of them, which is my favorite approach towards art anyway.
There is a brilliant book by a British writer called Jeff Dyer.
Yes, Zona. I've read it.
There you go. I was just going to recommend it, but you've already read it. And that's amazing, because it's so it's so much about him. I don't think he rewatches the film. He sort of writes the book from his memory of watching the film so many times when he was young. Mm-hmm. So Jeff Dyer is just one of my favorite writers. So him writing about one of my favorite films is a very sweet place to be.
It's a natural fit. Yeah. And I appreciate that he makes it so personal. I think all writing is personal anyway. So you might as well just reveal your hand in it while you're doing that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's not, it doesn't work for everybody, but when it's done well, it's the best, you know. Absolutely brilliant talking to you, Sarah. So much for being on Writers on Film.
Thank you so much for having me, John. This was a delight.
Being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.